Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. This is Kelly Garner, editor at Buyer's Meeting Point. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Kate Potasik as my guest. Kate is a well-known and respected authority on highly collaborative win-win relationships based on her award-winning research and the vested outsourcing business model. Kate has written 6 books and is a faculty member at the University of Tennessee. She has been recognized by World Trade Magazine as one of the fabulous 50+1 most influential people impacting global commerce. Kate is also a contributor for Forbes magazine and has been featured on CNN International, Bloomberg, NPR, and Fox Business News. Kate, thank you for joining me today.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to share our research and work at the University of Tennessee.
And speaking of your research and work, you've recently marked the release of your newest book, which is titled Strategic Sourcing in the New Economy, Harnessing the Potential of Sourcing Business Models for Modern Procurement. Now, for anyone that doesn't know, we'll give people a pass. This is a busy time of year. Anybody who hasn't already picked up a copy, can you start us off by providing a high-level description of the book and its thesis?
Well, great. You know, this is actually, as you mentioned, the 6th book in a series of books that we have on the concept of trying to become more collaborative, a win-win value creation type of relationship with suppliers, something that we call vested outsourcing. And so many people have come to me and said, gosh, Kate, I love the concept of these vested relationships, but we're just not ready. It seems too far away. It seems like a big leap to go from where we are now, these transactional-based deals all the way up to this, you know, win-win, shared risk, shared reward type of a deal. Is there a stepping stone? Is there a way that we could really shift along and get there in a step fashion instead of this leap of faith, as many people would say? And so what we wanted to do in this book is step back and think of it from a procurement perspective. So it's written for procurement folks, and it teaches people a concept that we call the sourcing continuum. So if you think about all of the categories that procurement people spend money on, right, on one side, let's say it's the left side of that continuum, are these more basic, true commodities. Well, the problem is people have learned the art of buying, and they're commoditizing and often over-commoditizing and cramming everything into these commodity-type procurement solutions. And as you move across the sourcing continuum, you then choose to have very strategic relationships with the supplier, and you're migrating up, creating value with the supplier. So there are 7 sourcing business models, ranging from basic goods and services that you might have on an automated catalog, you're not even really spending much time and effort, all the way into very, very strategic joint venture type relationships where you're choosing to make actual investments with the supplier in form of a subsidiary or a joint venture or co-op type of environment. So there's these 7 sourcing business models, and the theory is that you would now segment your suppliers differently. So instead of using the basic 2x2 version of some version of the Peter Kraljic's segmentation model, you would now begin to look at the business attributes that are driving your market forces, and those are going to be what's going to dictate which sourcing business model you use. Because in some cases, as you know, Kelly, there's not a lot of suppliers in some of these categories. You know, if I look at very sophisticated, high-end facilities in real estate management in an integrated fashion, there's really only about, 5 suppliers that can do that kind of high-end integration work that companies need. Now, if I just need a simple janitor, a housekeeper, you know what? That's fine. We can move down the sourcing continuum. So you're looking at your environmental factors and what you're trying to achieve by in that spend category, and those factors dictate your sourcing business model.
So now let me pick up on something that you were just saying, because I have read all of the Vested books, and I've always found it interesting that while procurement plays a role in Vested, I wouldn't have necessarily read the books and say that we're a main character. You know, we certainly have a role to play, but they were directed at a wider business audience. Do you think that despite that broad approach, Vested really appealed to procurement or became a tool that procurement people focused on? And what is it that you think is going on within the larger procurement world that gave that the ability to get such traction?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because you're absolutely right. When we first wrote the first book, and actually the majority of the books, are very neutral. They're not tailored to a procurement. They're not tailored to an operations person. They're not tailored to a supplier. It's really about how do we structure these complex outsourcing deals better in a very neutral way. And the majority early on were actually operations kind of people. So they were, for example, I picked on facilities and real estate earlier. They were the heads of real estate. So the heads of real estate operate the real estate. Yes, they have to go and pick a supplier every 3 years or 5 years per the procurement cycle. But you're right. They almost thought of procurement was a nuisance, right? Oh, my God, they're making me go through this bid process. Don't they understand I really like my existing supplier? And every time they went through the bid process, they would feel like procurement actually extracted value from their supply base and left them dead on the doorstep, and then they had to go work with them again. And so it was kind of frustrating. So, yes, early on, the operations-type people were the ones who were rallying around a Vested philosophy, almost backlash to procurement, because they're like, see, you don't get it. You're out there, you're treating us as a commodity, and we're not a commodity. We're this complex strategic thing. And so, but now, Kelly, what's so exciting is that over half of the people who come to our courses on Vested are procurement people, because they're looking at that going, wow, this is a great business model that we can use to change our perspective and our processes and how we work with these suppliers. So now we don't need to be seen as the arch enemy of the CIO or the head of real estate or the call center person who goes, don't touch my supplier. But really a value architect to craft these deals, to really architect these commercial agreements instead of I'm over here and you're over there. And that's one of the motivations that we had in writing the new book is to bring in, I mean, loud and clear, this book is purposely written for procurement folks. And it says the future of procurement is that you will learn when something is a commodity and when you have to architect value with your suppliers. And how do you architect value with those suppliers? And it gets to the guts of the business model that you're working under. These more sophisticated, performance-based, Vested deals, and as you know, joint ventures, right, a true joint venture, those are very, very different commercial structures. The contracts are totally different than a buy-sell transaction-based deal. So what we're doing is helping them realize that the tools that they've used in the past are not the tools that you need in the future to manage value creation, to manage these strategic relationships, these win-win relationships. Different tools in your toolkit, and how you need to migrate your skills and your processes to shift up that sourcing continuum.
Now, just like your work has, as you said, followed a continuum or a progression, there are some progressions that procurement seems to have been fated to follow. So they're usually marked by us following one approach almost exclusively until something, usually something external, forces us to try another. And one of the most common models in this area that I think about is the idea that we used to all agree almost unanimously that supply-based consolidation was the thing to do. It allowed us to centralize volume and have greater leverage and therefore drive all of the prices down, which, of course, over time, not only in some cases damaged our working relationships with suppliers, but also embedded this unintentional risk because we tethered ourselves to a single source or a single geography for supply, which made us far more prone to disruption. Now, do you think that the progression that procurement has followed, you know, I know you talk about in the book going from sort of a muscular approach where we're really beating up on our suppliers and then letting that play out, seeing the consequences of it so that we can move on to a more relational approach. Was that an evolution we needed to follow, or have there been opportunities before now to change direction?
Well, I think there's always been an opportunity to recognize that relational contracts are something that's a viable option. You know, it's funny because I think about history. You know, I give talks all over the world, and one time this person raised their hand and said, "Well, Kate, this isn't anything new. You know, we used to do this in the 1950s. You know, we had to sit next to our supplier's wife in church. You know, we didn't have contracts. We did these relational win-win types of things. We would never screw over our supplier a long time ago. But as we've perfected the art of buying, you know, as procurement, you have to credit Peter Kraljic in his 1983 article in Harvard Business Review that said, "Hey guys, you're not strategic. Procurement isn't strategic. Get with it." And so since then, you started to see 30 years of procurement growing up and learning how to be amazing buyers. But the problem is, these more strategic deals, you don't buy, you partner. They're not about a price. They're about a pricing model. They're not about managing the supplier. They're about managing the business with the supplier. And so what we used to do a long time ago, the pendulum swung to these more muscular approaches, and especially during the recession, in the late 2000s, you know, it gave everyone an excuse to go beat up on suppliers even more on price. And so the pendulum swung, and it swung too far. And what you're seeing is it's coming back to somewhere in the middle. And what we've tried to do is go, all right, let's look at the entire landscape of what organizations buy, and when should you have a commodity focus? So it's not that you should never have a commodity focus. There are lots of commodities out there, but there are a lot of things that we have over-commoditized that we shouldn't be buying. We shouldn't be buyers. We should be architects. And so helping people understand their environment and the factors of when they move to relational contracts and economic models around outputs and outcomes, right? The world is not a bunch of transactions. Right, 99% of all the things we buy and sell today are structured as transactional agreements, and that shouldn't be the case in the future. We need to consciously embrace relational contracting techniques and output and outcome-based economic models. And that's what we're trying to teach in the new book, is what are those models, and when do you use them, and how do you use them?
Now, I think one of the best justifications for following this new model or alternate model, if you've just been kind of stuck in ways of the past, is research, and I've heard it from several different places, that things have changed in the supply chain such that for many companies, they may be spending as much as 80% of their revenue with suppliers. Mm. So less and less is being done in-house. And I think if you take pieces of information or that trend and line it up next to what's happening with the as-a-service economy, so we're purchasing less things and contracting for more services, do you think that things like virtualization, as well as us buying more things as a service, are sort of aligning things to really make now the right time to follow new sourcing business models?
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, you go back 20 or 30 years ago, and you didn't really have these complex outsourcing deals. Life was simpler. You kept the complicated stuff in-house, as you mentioned. But you know what? We've had tons of outsourcing, of virtually everything you could outsource, and even things that had been outsourced, like janitorial. People are getting, the larger companies are saying, you know what, it's not just about having 600 janitorial suppliers and, you know, all these different suppliers, how can we manage that in a more integrated fashion? So you're seeing the emphasis on more strategic type of integration of goods and services, like you mentioned. You're seeing outsourcing come to play where, you know, 30 years ago you didn't see that. You're seeing globalization, right? So now my suppliers aren't next door. I'm not sitting at church next to them. So how do I build these relationships into somebody, into a supply base that may be 5,000 miles away? And you're seeing, you're seeing the ramification of companies gone too far with muscular approaches. And so it is. It's almost like the perfect storm. All these factors are building that, you know, they were all there 20, 30 years ago, but you didn't see them as much, right? Globalization, yes, there were the toy companies, you know, outsourced to China eons ago, right? So you had aspects of it. But now, as you mentioned, you know, not uncommon for a company to have 70-80% of their entire spend, their P&L, with suppliers. You have to learn how to work with suppliers in more strategic ways.
Now, you were right up front in saying in the book, and I give you credit for this because procurement is not necessarily the most risk-embracing audience. You say right up front that part one of your book in particular is controversial. And one of the things that, if I had to guess what people are going to find the most difficult to swallow, is the idea that some of the models that we have embraced for so long and that we have relied upon so much maybe aren't making the transition so well to a new way of doing things. And you specifically talk about Porter's Five Forces and the Kraljic model and the fact that maybe they've outlived their usefulness. It seems that each one may have something of a fatal flaw that prevents it from transitioning. Can you talk a little bit about the difficulties with those two models and what sort of role they might play for companies that are very comfortable with them?
Yeah, you know, it is, you know, I you debate as an author and an educator, do I put the elephant in the room, you know, and I just did a keynote speech for the sourcing interest group, and I said, I'm going to challenge four tools, and you've asked me about two of them today, you know, and I'm going to tell you that maybe, just maybe, you need to retire the Kraljic model. And I tell people that, and they go, oh, what you, how could we do that, right? And it, you know, again, 1983, Kraljic's model was written. 1979, Michael Porter, The Five Forces. And so here's what's wrong with them. They have, they're incomplete. So they were absolutely, are still absolutely fabulous tools that 10, 20, 30 years ago were phenomenal. But business has changed, and they're no longer phenomenal. They're good tools, but we need, they're incomplete, as I say in the book. So Porter's Five Forces, you know, one of the forces is your leverage, your power, right, your power over your supplier. And so what he teaches is if you don't have power, figure out how to get power, right? So what do? We commoditize, we bid out. So you're taught over the last 30 years to find ways to shift the balance of power to the buyer, right? Well, in 1983, Peter Kraljic comes along and he expands on that concept of leverage. One of his suggested in his four, you know, quadrants of segmentation, the goal is leverage and commoditization. So think about that. I segment into the four in the 2x2, and up here on the upper right is strategic. And what's he say? He says, well, you only want to be in that strategic bucket if you don't have power over your suppliers, right? So you have to work with them in a collaborative way because you can't leverage them and you can't commoditize them into the lower left-hand bucket. And so the strategies then that we're taught are to shift people to leverage and shift them down to commoditization. And that's exactly what we've done over the last 30 years. We've come up with procurement techniques that leverage and commoditize to the detriment of many of these categories. And this is why when the original vested outsourcing books came out, you had so many of the operations people were picking them up going, oh my gosh, the answer, procurement, the arch enemy evil is sitting there leveraging and being muscular and killing my supplier. and commoditizing them, they don't get it. And so it gave them a reason to be, to go, look, I should be in the strategic bucket. But procurement tools aren't enabling them to foster these strategic relationships, to architect them, right? We're taught to be good buyers, not good deal architects. And so, yeah, you know, I still believe in segmentation, but what we offer in the book is actually looking at your market around you, your environmental factors, and those environmental factors place you in one of the 7 sourcing business models. So it's still a segmentation philosophy, but it's a radically different segmentation philosophy. And I think, Kelly, that's one of the reasons why you know, it kind of resonates with you because of, you know, your whole, you know, the book and work you're doing around market assessments and market analysis. You want to embrace those factors. You know what? If you only have 5 suppliers that can do what you need, let's not, you know, Intel, we actually have a video from Intel. They were one of our pilots of our work. And what on the video, the head of supply chain logistics procurement says, Kate, there's only 5 suppliers that can do what we need. You know, we've gone through all 5. What do? Go back to the one we fired? And that's kind of where people are at today. They've, you know, on these more strategic categories, they've run through their supply base. They've left them, you know, dead on the street, you know, and they're not wanting to innovate. So they say you want innovation and the supplier's not giving you innovation. Well, maybe it's because they're not getting rewarded for innovation because you've commoditized them. So we have to get out of this little vicious cycle and embrace the fact that, yes, there are strategic suppliers and they are not transactional in nature. They're relational contracts. And they're either based on output or outcome-based economics. And so that it's teaching people when to move to those models, when and how.
No, and I think, and you know, and you mentioned some of the work I've done around supply market intel, and I like to think that if I'm guilty of anything, it's about being greedy with regard to the role I want procurement to play. I want us to play this bigger role. I actually think a lot of what we've been through has qualified us perfectly to get more involved in some of these more strategic areas. But then in a lot of ways, it's our own concept of what we're doing that ultimately holds us back. Now, let me ask you this, because I actually spent a lot of time in the part of the book where you talk about Porter's and Kraljic, and you mentioned just now there's a couple of other models that you try to maybe give people an opportunity to look at with fresh eyes. Because I was thinking, if I have to explain to someone the value proposition of this book, I think this is one of the most important new ideas that we need to come away with. And I was wondering, so specifically around Porter's, if we can put something other than building power at the heart of the model, such as, for instance, what if we were to put the goal of minimizing risk or a desire to control profit impact or building competitive advantage, can you take these models and change them or morph them, or is the logic of them such a mismatch with the current economy that we really should move forward and look at something completely new?
Well, and that's actually the mapping of the sourcing business model. So, you know, on the lower end, you know, I mean, call a spade a spade. If you're buying a pen, it's probably not strategic. It probably is a commodity. Right? It probably is. And so it's okay. It is okay to say, hey, I got a lot of power and leverage and you're just a commodity and I can switch you out tomorrow. So it's okay to use those mindsets. It's when you have environmental factors where you do have risk, right? So don't treat a supplier as a commodity when there is risk. Shift along the continuum to a more strategic sourcing business model where at the center of that isn't shifting risk, but sharing risk, mitigating risk. You know, and you talked about risk, and that's actually one of the ways that people can create value. You know, today, a lot of the legal organizations, legal counsels in these companies are creating standard terms and conditions, and they're like, hey, here's my contract template. You know, sign it or, you know, we're not doing business with you. So it's a very power-based approach or even making their way into the RFPs. if you can't agree to my standard terms and conditions, then you know what? I'm not even going to do business with you. Wow. What happens if we look at that and we begin to create a win-win situation where if we can work together to reduce risk, it creates value, right? So you're looking at value from a different lens. Instead of value extraction or value exchange, you're looking at it through a lens of value creation. So risk is a way to create value when you can mitigate, manage, or eliminate those risks, right? Cost reduction. So let's not look at price. Let's look at a pricing model where if the supplier can make investments to drive cost structure down, then we share in the reward of the cost structure going down. So the supplier actually makes more profit when they reduce your cost structure. The supplier makes more profit when they reduce your risk. The supplier makes more profit when they achieve a competitive advantage for you. Like, what if they could take a day or two out of your supply chain? That's a competitive advantage. So they would need
that would be huge
for that. It's huge. And I mean, think about inventory. Multiples of millions of dollars. Multiples of millions of dollars for most companies. So it's shifting from this value extraction to value exchange to value creation. And it is. It's that continuum. And knowing when to use which mindset, when to use which tools in your toolkit. Think about an RFP, right? And if I'm on the low end of the continuum, you know what? I can use an auction. I can use an auction. I don't need to see my supplier. It's a pen. Like, just auction it, right? However, as I move along the continuum, I should never be auctioning out my more strategic items, right? Because they're not commodities. They're a way to create value. And I love the case study, the Vesta case study, P&G and Juggling the Saw, because, you know, you look at that, and P&G doesn't look at facilities management as a commodity. They look at it as a competitive weapon. I mean, you're like, how can you do this? House clean. It's janitors. Really? You know, but beauty's in the eye of the beholder. So you can look at a commodity, and it actually isn't a commodity. McDonald's. Is beef a commodity, Kelly? Not for McDonald's. It's a strategic weapon. They only use vested agreements for their highly strategic supply chain partners. They would never think of beef as a commodity. They think of it as a way to create value with their suppliers and to eliminate and reduce risk. You know, you talked about risk. When's the last time McDonald's had an E. coli instance? 1986. 70 million people are served every day. And who drives the accountability for quality in the supply chain? The suppliers. The suppliers live and breathe. They're maniacal about risk.
Well, and so let me say this. So hypothetically, let's say I'm now a procurement person that has said to you, okay, I'm a convert. I understand the models, the dangers of the past. You know, one of the things that I've always found so ironic is we all learned it is strategic sourcing. We call it strategic sourcing. And then we follow it like a checklist. Nothing strategic can be done by following a checklist. It's more of a mindset. So if I say I'm awake to the risks of following these models too closely, can I move forward into a new model and not be in the exact same place of having followed the sourcing business models too closely, and I'll find myself back in sort of this same uncomfortable place in 2 years or 3 years or 5 years?
You know what? That's a great question. And if you think about it, you know, I have thought about that. And it's funny because I look at it and go, well, what's going to be the next thing after sourcing business models? I was like, well, you know, Peter Kraljic and Michael Porter have been around for 35 years. So, if sourcing business models can do what Kraljic's model did or what Lean or Six Sigma has done to the industry, that's a wonderful contribution to the industry. And you know what? Then someone else can come and come up with the next thing, right? But I look at what we're doing now, and we map with companies. You know, companies are mapping to these sourcing business models, and they're going, oh, my gosh, we're all of our spend is down here. You know, we at best in a preferred supplier model. And so they're not harnessing the potential to create value from this. So I would say let's focus on getting all those pliers that have been crammed into the lower end of the sourcing continuum up into the right component, up into the right business model, a performance-based and invested deal. Let's work on those, and then let's figure out maybe there's, the next wave. But, we move slow, as you know. How long have we been, perfecting Crowdgic and the different variations? The seven-step, the other model that I pick on is the seven-step or multi-step procurement process with a checklist, right? You go from this step to this step to this step to this step. I'm with you, Kelly. We need to be architects. These strategic deals, they're not about following steps. They're about making very smart decisions that create a competitive advantage, that create value, that reward for investment. So you have to learn a skill of architecting. So procurement of the future, yes, we'll still be buyers, but a huge chunk of what we buy, we're going to be architects.
Oh, if we could please just make that happen. Can I put in my request? Is this the right place to put in my request? Because I feel like so many of the roads that we've been down, and I talked about we over-consolidated and then we figured out the problems with that. We oversimplified and then we figured out the problems with that. We over-commoditized and we figured out the problems with that. I have to think that the silver lining to all of the mistakes that we've made is the bright future of acting from a more educated place. And speaking to that and the potential role of procurement, there's a short paragraph in part one that I'm just going to read. So for anybody that doesn't have the book, I'm pulling directly from the book. And then I have a question for you because I think this is critical to procurement's potential. And it says, organizations themselves present a major problem. They are stuck in an outdated approach to value creation that has emerged over the past few decades. They continue to view value creation narrowly, optimizing short-term financial performance in a bubble while missing the most important customer needs and ignoring the broader influences that determine their longer-term success. Do you think that there's a procurement problem in organizations, or are there enterprise-wide problems right now that procurement holds the solution to?
Yeah, that's a great thing. And I don't know if you've got to read Robert Hanfield's book, The Procurement Value Proposition, but that's kind of what he talks about. Yeah, so, he comes at it from a very different angle than I do. So our work is complementary, but it's teaching the same end game, but he comes at it from a skills perspective and how you would have different skills in as procurement folks. But I agree, think about your statement. 70-80% of our entire P&L is spent with suppliers today for many companies, and procurement does hold the keys to the kingdom. But they have to shift from suppliers are us versus them, and I'm the buyer, you're the supplier, really? Okay, well, who can control innovation in the future if 70 to 80% of your spend is from suppliers? Suppliers can add a ton of value. They can do amazing things to de-risk your business. But when you're treating them as I'm the buyer and you have to be compliant, and it's I'm smarter than you, here's your statement of work, what's your price? They are not motivated to bring you the best and brightest. They're going to go work with your competitors. So if we don't shift our mindset and we don't think of it as, wow, I'm procurement and I hold the keys to the kingdom to unlock all this value, right, you're not going to get there. So it starts with your mindset, but then your physical processes and mechanisms need to change because I can't say strategic supplier. I can't say value creation and then go reverse auction something, right? It's insane, right? And so that's what we see, and it is so humorous to me to see people saying strategic supplier, and I want innovation, but I'm not going to change I'm still going to run everything through Ariba, and the supplier's going to have 150, line of characters to put their answer in. You're not going to get a solution doing a strategic RFP in Ariba. right? It just doesn't work. And I love what Ariba's done. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
I think the software technologies have made us incredibly efficient. Every company should have an Ariba equivalent, right? Whatever the version is, automate that stuff. But you know what? You don't automate an RFP for a really strategic deal. It just doesn't make sense because you need to slow down and have the interaction. You need to request for a partner, right? You need to request for a solution, not I need to compare you apples to apples to apples. The beauty in value creation comes when a supplier looks at your problem and said, you really wanted a banana. Wow, I didn't know that, right? You're right. I needed a banana, but I bought an apple to an apple to an apple. So if we slow down and actually embrace these suppliers, they are quite talented, right? And some of these, I mean, these suppliers are bigger than a lot of the buyers, quite honestly, right? I look at SKF is one of my favorites. I pick on them in the book a little bit. They've just done some amazing things in how to document value. $10 billion, that's with a B, $10 billion supplier of bearings and lubricants, $10 billion. That's bigger than most buyers. Right, so who's better at understanding how to get your machines to work? This is why NASCAR partners with SKF to think about how to remove friction in engines. Who knows that better than SKF? Can I look at any manufacturing plant and begin to partner with SKF in a different way? Am I really buying a $5 bearing, or if I reduce some friction, if I spent $15 on my bearing, could it really reduce $58 worth of downtime on that machine, right?
Well, and
so
I think you make the point
way
in the book
about
that
it.
In a lot of ways, it's less about buying the bearing, and it's more about understanding the friction. And you actually make
mm-hmm.
that point very early in the book where you talk about when we find ourselves feeling friction, our reaction should not be to do something to make the friction go away really fast because it makes us uncomfortable. It should be to understand what's causing the friction, because really that discomfort is telling us that we've reached a time where we need to embrace some change with our suppliers.
Yes, and I love that. You're absolutely right. You know, I use this analogy when I give a speech. You know, everybody's seen the fly go bounce off the window, right? You've seen the poor fly, and he's like, bounce, and he goes, like, bounce, and he bounces off. And if you just step back and look, the door, you know, often there's a door or a window right around the corner, right? But that's exactly what we're doing. We're doing more of the same. So what do? We do an RFP, and now we, you know, put it on steroids. We take and have a supplier, and instead of having 10 really amazing measures that measure the success of the business, we have 100 activity level SLAs, right? And so we're like that fly bouncing off the window, and we want to do more of the same when actually we should be seeing, wow, there's friction. There's a window here. Let's slow down and look at the problem. Let's think about a different approach, right? Friction should be a sign that you need to slow down and have a different approach.
Now, one of the other things that you talk about, and I think we got close to it before, but I want to go back to it in detail, is you actually talk about the difference between process and mindset. And you quote Luke Williams, who's a professor of marketing, NYU's Stern School of Business. And he said, disruptive innovation is not just about following a process, like we were saying with sourcing. It represents a mindset, a rebellious instinct to discard old business cliches and remake the market landscape. So what can those of us do to build that mindset in ourselves and in our colleagues?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I love pilots, right? So if you don't know how to do something, give it a test, right? Give it a pilot. Just try it out. You know, if you don't like it, you can always go back to the old way. And so what we've seen, at least with organizations using Vested, is they're willing to pilot the concept. And they go, wow, that works, or gosh, I learned a lot from that. What can I do differently? And so that's all we ask. Take a supplier. You know, how many suppliers do you have? 5,000, 10,000? You know, we were doing some work with Novartis. They had 130,000 suppliers. Take one and pilot it, right? Let's just try it and see what kind of results you get. Learn. So, I mean, as a professional educator, that's my passion, is helping, you know, educate folks. And I think all too often we don't slow down and really try to learn and pilot and tinker and build. And this is why we're encouraging procurement to not just be buyers, but to be architects. You know, there's some skill behind being an architect and building a beautiful thing. You know, Frank Lloyd Wright, look at his amazing buildings. He had the exact same tools as everyone else, and look what he was able to build. We should be able to do this, the same thing, by picking suppliers and going, how do I architect value of the future? How do I take that spend, and instead of trying to leverage my spend because I spend a ton of money with a supplier, how do I architect and harness their power? You know, in the very last chapter of the book, in the conclusion, we use an analogy of the Yellow River in China and harnessing the power. I mean, for hundreds of years, the floods would come in, the raging floods, and it would kill thousands of people. And it was very uncontrollable. But you know what? We can architect systems, damming systems and different things that harness that power into something beautiful. And so why are we not taking our power, you know, so Porter teaches us to leverage our power, you know, to take our power over someone else. Why aren't we taking that power, combining it with the power of suppliers, and taking the friction out and creating these win-win beautiful solutions to our problems?
Now, in addition to the cases that you have in the book, we've actually seen some really interesting examples of trying to partner with suppliers in the news. So if I think of a range of success levels, at the upper end, at least as far as what we've seen so far, we have the incredibly successful Tesla Panasonic battery gigafactory, where Tesla is effectively the buyer. They own the IP for the battery technology. Panasonic is their supplier who is working with that IP, has some rights to use it for other things and with other customers. But it's a financial, it really is a financial collaboration as well as intellectual, because Tesla, if I'm remembering right, bought the property and built the factory. Panasonic has invested in all of the equipment and the staffing that needs to go inside. So that worked well. Now, on the lower end of success rates, you know, before all of this news hit with VW and the trip devices that they had put in the engines for emissions results, we were hearing an awful lot about the spectacular failure of their partnership with Suzuki. And it sounds like almost from day one, there were warning signs that that was not going well. For companies that want to be more collaborative, it would seem that wanting to be more collaborative is not enough to actually make it successful. Mm-hmm. You need to have the right supplier, the right circumstances, right? So if I'm someone that has this desire to go down the collaborative road, where do I start in terms of figuring out where I have the right combination of opportunity or challenges or suppliers or investment appetite to make sure I end up being a Tesla Panasonic and not a VW Suzuki?
Yeah, and that is an absolutely fantastic question, Kelly. So foremost, you have to have those kinds of discussions. So one of our books, as you know, is called Getting to We, and it's just negotiating, you know, agreements for highly collaborative relationships. And we start out and we say, start all your discussions. If you think it's strategic, you're saying collaboration, you're saying you want innovation, right? So start to have a discussion around trust, transparency, and compatibility. Because, you know, if you don't have good compatibility, I would say drug dealers shouldn't marry Southern Baptist, right? It's not going to work. Good intention won't get you there if you really can't, you know, don't like each other. And so then, if you're not able to be trusting and transparent, it's going to hold you back and create friction. So that's really the first thing that we look for, is if you think you want collaboration, you've got to have a different discussion up front, right? And get that raw you know, pick a supplier or partner that's going to have good compatibility, trust, and transparency. And then it's really about architecting the solution. And that is, in the book, we spend a lot of time talking about how do you architect these relationships. Because there are patterns that we see between success and failure. And so while I haven't, profiled those two that you mentioned in the book, if I went back and looked at them, I would bet that the Tesla Panasonic has architected their guts. And you talked about the financial. It's not just about ThinkClevers. There's a financial component, right? And as you move up the sourcing continuum, you see more and more of a financial component. It's not just saying win-win. It is financially win-win. You're moving from price to a pricing model where there's baked-in return on investments. The better the investment, the more return, right? And you're seeing how to share those returns equitably, and not evenly, but equitably. And if I looked at that and I looked at the VW Suzuki, I bet it wasn't architected to some of the rule sets that we look at. Now, we use an analogy of a system. We like system thinking. And so as you architect each of these sourcing business models, a relationship using a sourcing business model theory, you need to follow the rules of that system. You know, think of a system. A system is like your thermostat in your house, right? It gets cold outside, and the heat comes up. It gets hot outside, the air conditioner comes on. And so it is engineered to perform certain results. And what we look at is each one of these sourcing business models creates a system, and if it's not architected well, it goes wrong. And this is why I think it's so fascinating when companies are coming to us and they're saying, you know, it just doesn't feel right. I'm saying collaboration. I'm saying innovation. I think I did this, but what did I do wrong? We're looking at their system and going, yeah, you kind of cheated, right? You did this right, but you did that right. And you see that how it's actually baking in friction into this relationship. So we work to teach people how to create and architect these systems with their suppliers. And there are seven. Each business model is a system. There's seven systems. So the more we can learn how to architect those systems, the better we are going to be at crafting these relationships. Instead of just having good intent, now we can actually have not just say strategic supplier, but we can craft a deal that really is strategic. So then perhaps maybe one of the advantages to procurement people, and as I've mentioned, we have this enormous affinity for processes and systems and very structured things. If what happens doesn't end up being that we get to follow our checklist, at least there is still a reliance on a systems element in profiling the situation that you're in and therefore understanding what's the right sourcing business model to select.
Right. And, you know, and you talk about this checklist thing, and while we use a kind of a systems approach, the rules are rules, but you would actually architect your specific deal within that. So, a great example would be a pricing model. So in the vested sourcing business model, we teach pricing model with incentives that optimize the business, right, that optimize for the outcome. I've seen very different pricing models. So the P&G Jones Lang LaSalle pricing model is very different than the Dell Genco vested pricing model. Very, very different. But they all have a pricing model with incentives that optimize the business. So I, like you, don't like these little checklists because I think what they do is they make us stupid, right? We go check the box, and we aren't thinking. We're not architecting. And so we've fallen into this, I'll say, best practice instead of best fit. And so just because someone calls something a best practice doesn't mean it's going to fit for you. So I prefer to have a system thinking approach and I'll call it a cheat sheet, right? So here's a cheat sheet with the rules. Follow the rules, but architect your deal for your specific situation, right? Because your pricing model with incentives may be different than someone else's pricing model with incentives, and they'll just go, well, that's what they did. I'm going to copy it exactly.
So as I was saying when I gave you the intro, and we've covered a lot of ground since then,
you spend an awful lot of time doing research and then putting out books and articles and sharing what you've learned. Can you give us a little bit of a sneak peek or a hint as to what is next for you and the whole Vested team? Are you delving more down the procurement road? Will you be broadening back up to some of the operational or outsourcing models? What do you see of being sort of on the horizon, your next area of focus or research?
Yeah, you know, that's a great point. I think in the very near future, we've had a lot of demand from public procurement going, gosh, I really like what you're teaching, but we're public procurement, we're different. And so, but I have a professor who teaches public procurement, very, very well-known professor, Dr. Steve Gordon, who actually was a practitioner. He was Davidson County's chief procurement officer. And so he said he's really wanting to collaborate and create a government-focused public procurement book around sourcing business models that uses their language so they feel more comfortable shifting along the continuum because it's in their language. So he wants to kind of convert that. So I think that's a near-term thing. But, you know, another thing that we're really working on doing is educating people through our Certified Deal Architect program. We want buyers, suppliers, consultants, and lawyers, we love everybody, to learn these new ways, these new philosophies. And so really spending time doing a lot of train the trainers. So I have discussions with SILF and Navy. Navy, NEVI, is a Dutch procurement association to potentially incorporate sourcing business models into some of their seminars that they teach. Because you know what? Not everyone can come to Knoxville. So let's do some train the trainers and get these associations to begin to, you know, replace some of the older things that they're teaching with some of the new, more modern stuff. The Sourcing Interest Group, great, you know, love those guys. They actually incorporated the new book and entire sourcing business model theory into their SIGU training. And so they had, just like you did, Kelly, I'd sent you a pre-copy just to get your feedback. And Don, Tiara had read it and said, oh, my gosh, we have to be teaching this stuff. So we want to really work with these associations and other universities. So much of our work is actually open source. As you know, it's free. And so, hey, here's these free tools. You know, begin to get that embedded into your curriculum, into your, I was talking to a company today who has a procurement academy for their own company, right? They have a little procurement training program, and they're going to be implementing sourcing business models into their own procurement academy. And our toolkit's open source. Like, why not? It's free. Embed it in. And so that's really exciting to me, is to be able to get critical mass where we have enough people that are skilled in training this stuff, where they don't have to just come to Knoxville. But we want to be kind of the black belt trainers, train the trainer, per se. You know, think of it as green Six Sigma green belts and black belts. We want to train up all these black belts so that they can go and be embedded in organizations, buyer, supplier, law firms, consulting firms, that they are the black belts of procurement in the future when it comes to architecting these more complex deals and shifting up the continuum.
And we want to get out there and we want to fight the good fight, right?
Yep. So education, you know, there's a difference between teaching and educating. Teaching, I can just tell you something. Education means I now learn so deeply that I'm going to change what I'm doing. And that's what drives my passion, is to educate people so effectively that they begin to see things that were there, they just couldn't see it before. It's a fly against the wall. Or it's McDonald's saying, is beef a commodity? No way. It's a strategic weapon. What if we can take, if only each company just picked one supplier and said, what if I looked at them differently, treated them differently, and architected a different deal? What kind of value can I create? What kind of risk can I reduce?
And so because you have made so much of that available, and obviously some of it is in the book, but an awful lot of it is available as open source resources on your site. I want to make sure that everyone knows how to connect with this information. So the title of your new book is Strategic Sourcing in the New Economy, Harnessing the Potential of Sourcing Business Models for Modern Procurement. And it is now available for purchase. For anyone interested in learning more about your overall body of work, I will make sure to post a link to the Vested Way site on today's episode page where people can link out to all of your resources to get started down that better, more futuristic path. Kate, thank you so much for the conversation. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Well, thank you, Kelly, and I'm glad that you've enjoyed the book and you're enjoyed it so well you're asking me to share, because that's, again, without sharing knowledge, we can't go to a better place.
That's absolutely true. Kate, thank you so much for your time.